No. All right, hi everyone. I'm going to call the meeting to order. It may not look like it, but we actually have a cheap quorum because there's so many huge absences. I also will be facilitating this meeting. I apologize in advance for having to deal with me, but none of our co-chairs are available, so you're stuck with me. Let's start with a roll call. Chuck Adams.
Here.
Robert Arnold.
Here.
Erwin Barrios.
Here.
Leroy Glenn.
Here.
Bill Wilmer Excuse. Anna Branzuela.
Here.
Jesse Brooks.
Here.
Franklin Chevalier, if I'm leaving that. Ed Chitty, if I'm leaving that. Patrick Davenport, if I'm leaving that. Elaine Flores. Elise Griffin. Jesus Guillen.
Here.
Elise is here. Thank you. Ron Hernandez,
here.
Lee Jewell,
present.
Thomas Noble is excused. Navi,
here.
TJ Lee Miyawi, Helen Lynn, Derek Matz, I'm a leader of Athens, Marco Montenegro, John Ofkinson is excused. Irma Ferrado, Andre Robertson,
here.
Johnny Rodriguez,
here.
Charles Cerrone, J.P. Soto is excused. Richard Sullivan.
Here.
Laura Thomas.
Here.
Manuel Vasquez.
Here.
To council staff, Mark Molnar, council staff.
Yeah.
Now let's do members of the public. Let's start with Natalie, the department.
Johnny Julia Titchens.
Anna Hilton.
Mark Manington Gross.
Jonathan Proctor, Census Place Foundation.
Molly Herzog, Richard.
Stephen Spallon, the AIDS of the World Pearl Family.
Helen Hale, OCD.
All right. Now, if you have not signed in, if you're a member of the public, please do so at some point during the meeting. There's a sign sheet far left. With that said, if we can put up the agenda, and we're going to take a look at our draft agenda. Oh, Amina. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm going to take a look at the draft agenda. Depending on how fast the agenda items move along, we might do a little bit of switching with agenda number 11, but we'll keep that there for now. Any changes, updates, comments on the agendas? Any public comment? All right, any opposed to approving the agenda as written? Being not approved by consensus. We can take a look at the draft minutes. Thank you, as always, Kat, for providing the link and field notes. I appreciate it. Any changes, updates, comments on the draft minutes from last week's meeting? Any public comment on the draft minutes from last month's meeting? Any opposed to approving the draft minutes from last month's meeting as written? All right, we're back to consensus. Next, we move on to council member announcements. Any announcements from you, council members? Yes, Laura.
Most of this is an update about the city budget and where the HIV provider network is. As you know from our previous conversations, the Department of Public Health proposed some pretty substantial cuts in behavioral health and HIV prevention, affecting a lot of our HIV providers. As well as cuts to LGBTQ health, particularly trans healthcare, and the mayor restored funding for cuts that came from the mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development around LGBTQ services, but did not touch any of the Department of Public Health cuts. So that is all moving forward, and is now at the board of the budget is at the board of supervisors. This is the last week of deliberations at the board of supervisors. Thursday is the day that is colloquially called add back night, where the members of the board would like try to squeeze money out of the mayor's budget, then try to add it back to address community needs and concerns. One of the things that is essentially a piece of good news that we've heard is that we got this, the Human Services Network announced this morning, that it looks like there will be a 2.4% cost of doing business increase for all general fund contracts. That is, while not, I don't think, keeping up with the pace of inflation or rent increases, is still better than what we got last year. And so those of you who've been through this process a number of times know that one of the things that happens as over the years Ryan White has shrunk and we have collectively successfully advocated for general fund to ensure we don't lose any services there. When they do cost of doing business adjustments, they only do it on the general fund contracts and not on Ryan White. So every year, the HIV's provider network goes in and advocates for parity across all of the contracts to make sure that there's additional funding to keep the Ryan White contracts level with the general fund ones. And so the things from Department of Public Health, we now know that that figure would be about $413,000. So we are working with the Board of Supervisors to try to get that added to their list of things for add backs. And we will see, you know, Supervisor Mandelman has long been a substantial champion for HIV funding. And so HIV's provider network is in communication with all of them and trying to get both as much back and add backs as we can to try to keep as much of the system of care whole as we can. So that is a sort of long print announcement, but it seemed like the budget, this is for a fiscal year that starts July 1. And so the Board of Supervisors will finalize everything by the end of the night, Thursday night, the ad back night, hopefully. And then they hand it off to the mayor to hold sign. And the mayor's office continues to be involved in these conversations. My colleagues in the HIV Advocacy Network have been doing a lot of community advocacy, a lot with in conjunction with the People's Budget Coalition. You know, after the mayor reversed these NOHCD cuts, wanted to say, oh, I fixed everything, but obviously, as we all know, there continue to be pretty substantial cuts to LGBT health services and other services, as well as to HIV prevention and harm reduction. So they've been trying to make the point that the mayor's not that much of an ally. He was cutting our services instead of standing up with us, particularly in the face of cuts and attacks from the Trump administration. So that's it. If people have any questions, I'm happy to answer them here, or happy to answer them offline as well. And thank you everyone here who's been part of AIDS and this is, we're all doing our parts in all our different ways.
Any questions or comments for Laurel's announcement? Any other council member announcement? Any public comment on any of the announcements? I thought you raised your hand, Steven.
Oh, no, I was waving.
Oh, hi. So, any public comment? General public comment. All right, move on to staff announcements. I can start. I'm not sure if there's any further. beyond me. This is just a reminder for those who did not turn in their renewal application. Turn in your renewal application. By the end of this week, if you do not turn in your renewal application, let's do a little bit ago, then you will not be renewed. We have to actually turn that into the mayor's office yesterday. So please, right now we're on a little bit on hold while we wait for the remaining people to turn in their renewal applications if they would like to continue on the council. Any other staff announcements?
Just a reminder, you also fill out those surveys for today's meeting. If you're here at community, and you would like to be
So on to general updates. We do not have a couple of our general updates that usually appear because Thomas Noble couldn't join us. However, I did notice that there is a written chat update. So if you have any questions for Thomas, feel free to give it to any of the staff and we'll forward it on to them. And with that said, I'd like to ask John to provide our HHS update for Bill.
Hey. Hello, everybody. Nice to see everyone again. A couple of quick updates here. Around our budget, we have received all of our funding award, those of award for Part A, PHE, and Part C. So we're good to go there. Part A did receive a 5% cut. We'll be receiving an additional 5% over the next 4 years, but the state was generous enough to backfill that for us. And EHE got a little bit of a bump. We got about 2% increase in EHE. And that should be going to food, housing, employment, counseling, old medical case management, whole wide array of services that currently are funded by EHE. What else do we have here? Yeah, so the additional amount is actually $467,894 added onto EHE. And again, yeah, so the additional funding will support housing case management, EFA, emergency financial assistance, and long-acting injectable services delivered through home-based medical case management. Lastly, we have our HHS quarterly CQI meeting coming up. The last one was at the beginning of April. This one will be at the beginning of July, July 9th. And you all are more than welcome to attend. And thanks, Laura, for the COVID update. That will be ongoing. We'll have more information by this time next month. Any questions at all?
No questions for the HHS report? Any public comment on the HHS report? Thank you, John.
Okay, we'll see you all in September. Summary sheets?
Yes.
September is the old man.
Yes. All right.
So the lawmakers are advancing the fiscal year 27 appropriation bills, including that House Appropriations Committee, which includes labor, HHS, education related agencies, which are where the funding is located. They met on June 9th to mark up the bills, and the funding pretty much came along card lines. And they're teeing up for a package for consideration on the House floor. If passed into law, the House mark would dramatically reshape infectious disease prevention program at the Department of Health and Human Services and the agencies and operating divisions, including CDC and Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA. Notably, the bill would eliminate all funding for HIV prevention except for the ending HIV epidemic initiative, and consolidate funding for viral hepatitis, STD, and infectious disease, and opioid programs. So we're really counting on the Senate to reverse that. Congress has until September 30th to reach a bipartisan agreement on the federal funding for fiscal year 2027. As I mentioned, the Senate appropriators have not yet released a bipartisan spending framework, which may deviate from the spending proposals approved by the House. NASDAQ will continue to monitor that. Regarding CARE, we had a virtual meeting on the 9th, and I'm going to wait for Bill to come back to talk about that. I think it would be best to talk about where CARE is heading. So beyond that, I have nothing else. Moving further.
Any questions or comments for Lee's CARE Coalition update? Any public comment on this update? All right, I'll turn it over to Leroy to give us a state of the day update.
Thank you very much. My name is Leroy Blay. I use he, him, and his pronouns. I'm the Part B state representative, also the Ending the Epidemics Program a manager with the California Department of Public Health Office of AIDS. Just a few quick updates. First, John highlighted the fact that we were able to redistribute some Part B funds to take care of a shortfall in San Francisco with Part A. This is actually an effort of the State Office of AIDS to make sure that we spend every drop of Part B funding in places that it's truly needed. So I'm just going to note that in our Part B reports going forward, and I'm making this announcement in all jurisdictions, we're going to be talking about where there's some funds that are sort of underspent in different parts of the state and where we might want to take a look at both Part A and Part B together to make sure that we're spending down as much as possible, because at many places, California is making the argument that we continue to need this vital funding to continue to fund our infrastructure, and any underspending at this point actually counters that argument. So help us make that argument. Continue to do a wonderful job, as San Francisco always does, in spending down your Part A and Part B. And we just congratulate you for doing that. And we're very sorry that a lot of hits are happening all at once and all at the same time. But we're looking to continue to partner with you to make sure that we continue to have contingency funds for prevention and other vital services. I am also just going to announce briefly that California is hosting this year the U.S. Conference on HIV and AIDS, and there are a number of individuals across the state that are part of the host committee, and so we are wanting to have a good showing to show exactly what California does and how we do this wonderful work, and having a large number of presentations that showcase California's work. So we're also looking for 200 volunteers, and there are going to be a number of lounges focused on youth, on people living with HIV. Volunteers actually get free registration for the U.S. Conference on AIDS. And this is, I'm just going to go ahead and put the information in the chat. This is going to be in Orange County this year. So please, attend this year. And it's going to be a real vital kind of like one-on-one or like a small, not small, but I would say that sort of really discussing what we can do as a field to address some of the shifts in policy and funding that have happened nationally. And so we're looking forward to that venue. Also, the Ending This Endemic Symposium is, once again, made this announcement before, but we're looking forward to hosting a virtual symposium September 29th through October 1st. We're going to have a variety of sessions that are community advocate and consumer focused. We have a lot of voices of community and those lived experience to participate in the session. So please feel free to, this is a free virtual Syndemic Symposium that helps us sort of look backwards and look forwards about how we could make the best next steps to addressing the syndemic of HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs through a social determinants of health lens in California. And then finally, there has been a need to, that has been identified to talk about how to deal with that vital transition for individuals that are transitioning from Medi-Cal to Medicare as they age in the epidemic. And so HRSA has made some resources available to train providers on to help make clients actually make that vital transition. And the last on the series of presentations is going to be tomorrow, June 23rd. There are additional sessions that have happened that are everything from the basics of Medicare through more sophisticated ways of actually helping clients that are dually eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. And so please use those resources as we've asked for them, and HRSA definitely responded to that. So that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me. Yeah.
Questions or comments for Leroy?
Also, I'm just going to say that the OA voice is in your packet, and feel free to read through that. And I'm not going to go through that, but there's some interesting items in there, particularly about a condom availability program that's going on statewide for California high schools. And thanks to those of you that advocated for that, because that was a direct legislated funded activity for prevention for youth in California.
Any public comment on this topic? No? All right, so I'm actually gonna switch, as mentioned, I'm gonna switch the agenda up a little bit so maybe we can get out of here a little bit earlier. Let's do carry forward allocation, which was agenda item 11. Please pull out your handout and put that up. It's a handout that has a double PowerPoint on each page, fairly short. All right, so let's just jump into this. I want to first of all thank HHS for providing the most aesthetically pleasing carry forward recommendation list that I've seen in my entire life. Incredible. The detail work. All right, next slide, please. HHS has helpfully shown us our different service categories, how potentially use carry forward allocation within, keeping in mind, of course, the carry forward allocation must be attached to specific service categories that we fund. Next slide, please. We'll see here highlighted in red the actual recommended, the actual service categories were recommended to receive the carry forward funding. Next, we'll look at the actual motion. This is a motion that's on the floor. It's coming from the steering committee where it was approved. And so it does not need to be moved or seconded in this meeting. It'll just be up for discussion and updated or amended. So we'll see here four usual suspects, four different service categories that have actually received carry forward funding in the past. First, we have emergency financial assistance in the amount of $120,000. Will be able to be provided to 154 clients in $700 increments. As mentioned, this is a service category that we have used before. I think every year we provide some carry forward funds to this service category because they're quite easily processed and released. Moving on, we have food banks / home delivered meals. The proposed amount is $207,593. It'll come specifically from Minority AIDS Initiative, subset of Ryan White Party funding. It is for both food pantry / groceries and home delivered meals. As you can see right below that, it shows that with this carry forward funding, 120 clients can receive 12 meals a month at $15 a meal for 5 months. All right. And then for home delivered meals, you'll see 167 clients can receive 4 bags a month at 30 bags, at $30 per bag. Again, much like with emergency financial assistance, food appears every year for us to provide carry forward funding. On to a couple of special projects that have also appeared in past iterations of recommendations. So we'll see mental health service categories for trainings. The trainings will cover two different areas. One is trauma-informed care training that particularly focuses on long-term survivors and aging. This will be for 5 trainings. The second topic area of trainers curriculum for mutual aid, i.e. clients helping clients, in living healthfully. There will be peer-led groups such as Positive Force, pilot training 1 or 2 times. Training is also a regular place where we put carry forward funding. And finally, in under other professional, we have legal stipends for $20,000, sorry, the prior amount is $49,000 for EO2. For legal stipends, this will support additional legal service interns who will in turn support client case research and client interviews to address emerging legal needs, and particularly focusing on the housing crisis. As I mentioned, this is another one that we have actually done in the past. So moving on to the last slide, just to sum up, all of these are for allowable person service categories. These are services that go directly to clients. This council has approved these service categories in similar amounts in the past. And we do know that all of these funds can be spent down by the identified agencies identified by HHS in the allowable time period. And they have a history of doing so. You'll see, once again, all of the different amounts that HHS has recommended and that each committee, has gone through each committee, has also approved. So that said, the floor is now open for discussion of the motion on the floor, which is essentially this last paragraph. No discussion. All right. Any public comment on this carry forward motion? All right, this does involve, yes, Stephen.
I just want to thank you in support of the allocation for legal additional legal services.
our agency, like other legal aid organizations, relies very heavily on interns and new lawyers and beginning lawyers to try and support. Oftentimes, they are our very first point of contact for clients. And particularly in the housing realm, this is a constantly growing need. And our eviction defense team, just like the eviction defenders around the city, really do appreciate the support from any support from the community to increase their capacity. We are oftentimes in a position of having to put pauses on taking new eviction cases because of capacity. In the past, I think we have a pretty proven track record of being able to use this money in a very lean fashion. So I just want to speak to the board about it.
Thank you, Stephen. Any more public comment on this motion? All right, this does involve resources, so this will be a roll call vote. This is a reminder, I cannot call on individual members until their appointment has been approved by their call. Chuck Adams.
Yes.
Robert Arnold.
Yes.
Erwin Barrios.
Yes.
Leroy Blea.
Yes.
Anna Branzuela.
Yes.
Elaine Flores. Ron Hernandez.
Yes.
Lee Jewell.
Yes.
Na Lee.
Yes.
TJ Leon.
Yes.
Helen Nguyen. Charles Serrone. Richard Sullivan.
Yes.
Laura Thomas.
Yes.
Manuel Vasquez.
Yes.
All right, motion carries. You're finished with carry forward. And just in time for our presentation from coming up, you can come on up to the podium and present us. Dr. Arnold, I'll let you have it.
Again, everyone, my name is Mona. I'm the Advocacy Research Coordinator with ARCHES. Thank you for having me in this space. I'll be talking about the HIV, AIDS, toilet infection, micro-elimination round in San Francisco.
Can you speak up just a little?
Yeah. So today I'll be going over our program goals, an overview of the workflow of the program, as well as the outcomes from both our pilot and our second phase of the program, and then finish up with some lessons learned. So the goals of this program are first to identify patients living within San Francisco or receiving care in San Francisco who are living with an HIV infection. We wanted to collect accurate and up-to-date information on these patients, specifically around their Hep C status and treatment progress, as well as their demographics and risk factors. We then wanted to link interested patients to Hep C navigation and treatment, and also strengthen our relationships with Hep C providers and community-based organizations that provide Hep C services within the city. So here is just like an overview of the last couple of years working on the project. We started in 2021 developing the standard workbook, our scope of work, and our outreach materials. And then I started to identify patients and validate their data by doing chart review and provider outreach. And then we also started outreaching to those patients for initial care. Once we wrapped up the program in 2023, we focused on evaluation and reviewed our outcomes to identify if some can improve on for the next phase of the work. Based on those outcomes, we edited our process and some of our data collection materials, and then started in 2025 the second phase, which again included identifying patients, validating their data through provider outreach chart review, and then outreaching the patient. The patients were identified through a match between the HIV case registry and the Hep C case registry. And so this was done by an HIV epidemiologist and an Hep C epidemiologist. So they worked together, create a list of patients, and then that list was then shared with them.
This list included data about their testing history and available demographics. It also included the patient's Hep C status, which was defined by CDH and based on their available lab records. And this also provided a priority categorization, so it was based on their lab status. For the purpose of this program, we did kind of expand these definitions that were included by CDH to include evidence of clearance and cure that was found in their medical records, and also based on feedback from their providers. So you can see here, but these are the definitions that we used for case investigation. So we had patients who were viremic were considered high priority. And these were folks who had a positive HCV RNA viral load lab test and no evidence of clearance or cure. We also had folks who were medium priority, where they just had an antibody test. So an antibody test shows just that they may have had Hep C in the past, but it doesn't show that they have an active infection at the moment. So these are folks who need additional testing to confirm the infection. And then we also had our low priority patients, and these were folks who had evidence of clearance or cure, again, based on lab results, electronic medical records, or confirmation of the patient themselves for their care. And then we also had folks who were ineligible or had their case closed for a number of reasons, including deceased or out of jurisdiction, or having like no record that they had an active infection, or if they themselves made like new priorities and didn't want to engage with their Hep C at the time. So our pilot, we started with a list of 1,199 patients, and this included cases that were reported from 2018 to 2021. So this was, again, sorted into those different categories that I just showed you. And from there, we focused just on folks who were high and medium priority. So we needed treatment or additional testing. And so from there, we had 516 to investigate. We focused, we sorted these patients based off of their clinic, their primary care clinic, and started outreach to providers within the SFHN network. This was a way to kind of give us an opportunity to kind of test our processes and materials and receive feedback from providers that we already had an established relationship with. From there, we moved on to investigation for patients who were receiving care in external healthcare systems, such as like Sutter, Dignity. And so here you can see a list of the data that we started to collect. It included patient contact information, a variety of demographics, their Hep C testing and treatment history, their hepatitis vaccination history, risk factors, barriers to care, as well as who's on the care team. So it's a pretty exhaustive list, and that was in part because our goal was to collect up-to-date data. But based on feedback from our providers that we worked with, we recognized that this was kind of unfeasible for folks to complete. We were also collecting data from providers through a form that we had created in Word. And so that was also kind of adding on to the workload of getting this data. So that was a point that we changed going forward and into phase two. And so from here, we focus mostly on contact information and then their Hep C testing.
You're doing pretty good, but you kind of still can't hardly hear you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Okay, and so this is kind of the flow of where the cases went throughout this program. So you can see here, we started with our 516 patients who needed investigation. After chart review, about a fourth of them had their cases closed. And then we had 407 patients that we investigated with our provider outreach. From there, we had half of that, so 200 patients we needed outreach to link to care. And so these folks, I was able to reach 41 of the people I outreached to, and about half provided evidence of their behavior, and half were still in need of treatment. Okay, so this is a table with just a simple breakdown of who our vision population was. It was primarily folks who were non-Hispanic, Latino, who were male, and who were white, followed by folks who were Black or African. So these are the outcomes of our pilot patient outreach. So this was done to both confirm their Hep C status and also to link them to care, which involved linking them to low threshold testing or treatment opportunities within the community. So that could include linking them to Navigators at the Johnson Project or linking them to treatment at SF Community Health Center. And so that was the goal of this outreach. But unfortunately, we had a lower response rate of 20-25%. I was able to reach 41 out of the 200 patients outreached to. And so half of them had completed treatment or were in care for treatment. And then about half are still in need of treatment. And 11 of those folks were referred to care. And then a small amount of them, 8, did decline services. And so this is like an interesting opportunity to understand why they declined services. So we had folks naming provider stigma, transportation barriers, and concerns about the side effect of Hep C medication as some of their barriers for completing care. We also had a couple folks named competing priorities such as other health concerns and other chronic conditions that they wanted to focus on before addressing their Hep C. And so this is just an overview of kind of what we ended up at the end of the pilot. So we had 46% of patients who we investigated had cleared or cured their Hep C infection, and then 45% were still in need of testing for treatment. And so we did have success in confirming a lot of this information, having about 46% of people based just on surveillance data who weren't cleared or cured. And finding evidence of their cancer care was a big success for us. We also strengthened our relationships with our Hep C providers and built relationships with our external health systems. Another success that came out of this is we started Hep C care coordination meetings. And so these are a monthly meeting where we have folks from community organizations and clinics who provide Hep C services come together and kind of discuss challenges that are coming up or discuss any like shared patients they may have. In terms of revisions based off of the pilot, we did update our case definitions as mentioned earlier. And then we also reduced the amount of data we were collecting for providers to focus mostly just on Hep C and the patient's treatment and testing history, as well as who else is the patient in contact with, like who else is on their care team that we can try to get in touch with to find some of these patients. And then another revision we did is with the help of our informatics team, we built out our data storage system and data tracking workflow within the Hep C registry to kind of make it easier to complete this process on the back. Following those revisions in 2025, we began phase 2 of this work. And so this was a smaller phase. We had 665 cases reported from 2021 to 2023. And from there, about a third 206 records were prioritized for case investigation. Again, the biggest change to the process was simplifying the data collection process. So reducing how we collected the data from providers, switching from a form to a simple email, and then also the amount of information asked. And we also expanded our focus from just like their primary care provider or absentee provider to a patient's health care team. So we could improve our chances of getting updated information. So here is the flow of patients throughout the process. After chart review, that helps validate evidence of clearance in care for about 3/4 of the patients. So we had 52 patients moving into provider outreach, and then 36 moving into patient outreach. Of the 36 folks that were outreached to in this phase, we were able to contact 8, with 1 providing evidence for cure and 7 still in need of treatment. This is a little more detailed of a breakdown of the demographics. Overall, the patient population was pretty similar to the pilot, non-Hispanic, Latino, white, male, and then highlighted in orange are some subpopulations where there was a disproportionate amount of clients who were by remit in comparison to their percentage of the total 206 patients. And so that included Black or African American clients, as well as those with unstable housing status. So they were a little overrepresented in our by remit. Similarly with patient outreach as with the pilot, we had a little bit of a lower response rate around 22. I was able to contact 25 folks. And so of the 8 we did contact, 5 of them were referred to care. 1 provided evidence of care, and then 1 declined services, naming competing priorities. And then 3 were out of jurisdiction. So this phase of the program confirmed cure and clearance for 73% of folks on our initial list, and then 19% were in need of testing. So here you can see a comparison between the 2 phases of the work so far. Specifically circled are the percent of folks who had clearance with care and the folks who were by remit. So you can see that in the first phase, we had 52%, around 53% of folks had evidence of clearance with care at the end of the pilot, versus phase 2, we had around 73%. So it is a pretty big improvement. And so we're still trying to figure out exactly why, but some potential reasons that have come up are, 1, the list is based off of surveillance data. And so our surveillance registry doesn't necessarily include the data that was found in the pilot or in the electronic medical records. So our second list for our second phase didn't include clients who were on the previous list. We didn't already have evidence come up in our case investigation. Secondly, we did have an easier time accessing some of the data from external health systems in our second phase, thanks to the contacts we found during our pilot. And so that helped improve the amount of data we were able to access during that part of the work. And then 3, we also, again, expanded our focus from just primary care providers and Hep C providers to different members of the care team, such as nurse managers and navigators, to maybe be able to provide more insight on barriers to care or up-to-date information on patient Hep C status. So overall, the second phase validated clearance and care for the amount of folks. It also gave us an opportunity to identify gaps within our surveillance system and improve on those. And then we have continued to strengthen our relationships with our providers and our community orgs that we work with, and also highlighted in this report. And those areas specifically are education for our providers and patients around current treatment regimes and their benefits. So as noted in the pilot, some folks have made concerns about the side effects of medication. And with Hep C, the medication process has changed a lot since it was first available. And so making sure that folks are understanding what the current treatment regime can help improve like their confidence in treating their Hep C. Another area of improvement is individualized follow-up for our patients. So a good amount of our patients that I was trying to get in touch with are in unstable housing situations, and maybe don't have the most up-to-date contact information. So locating them to see where they're at in terms of treating their Hep C, as well as facilitating that linkage to treatment, can be a little difficult when it's just over the phone or something, and these folks may not have access to the phone number that I have for them. So seeing different ways that we can get connected with these folks is something we want to improve on. And so going forward, this program is going to hopefully continue on an annual basis, and we can work towards getting as many folks as we can at least thinking about their Hep C treatment, and then getting them connected to care when they're ready to focus on that. Yeah, and so this is a big list of all the folks who helped work on this and get us to where we are now with this program. And yeah, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments? Yes, Jesse.
So my question would be the approach to the patient, because you get all this information on them. Do you guys make like cold calls, or do the providers tell them that someone's going to call you?
Yeah, so we try to have providers let patients know when, because I was the one doing the call. We try to have providers let them know when I was going to call them. Sometimes the patients were out of care with their provider as well. So in those cases, it's more of a cold call. We also mail letters to patients. So we would send a letter letting them know that, hey, I was going to call. And if not, you'll also like receive another letter with the data form in the mail. And so they did receive that. And then patients also, for completing the call with me and, or completing the data form via mail, they received the incentive for it. So there was something there for them rather than us just taking this information.
Right,
because
that would freak out.
Yeah, no, understand. And I think that is why, like, cold calling isn't the best approach. Like, I think a lot of us, myself included, don't pick up the 911 number. So that's why we want to try to leverage some of the relationships patients have with, like, their navigators or their providers to get in contact with them.
And one more thing, I just have a suggestion, like maybe commercials that show how successful treatment is today.
Yeah.
That people would be more comfortable if they saw that
we're
there was
success. Okay. Yeah, maybe.
I think I thought InnoScan first and then Andre.
I do want to thank you for this. This is a huge undertaking. I've been an investigator, and we're trying to do this in San Mateo. So 500 people, that's probably over 10,000 lab reports you have to go through. So I know this is a great deal of work. In San Mateo, we also are trying to have priority, go up, trying to identify priority populations, such as people co-infected, women of childbearing age, and things like that. But what we're finding is our individuals that are incarcerated, they get routinely tested, but no one follows up. They go to a different jurisdiction. So some of those folks that you mentioned, cross-jurisdiction, I'm going to reach out to you to see if we have some combined people that we may be able to make sure they're linked in different, because people are going from Alameda, Santa Clara, here, and especially those unhoused and incarcerated. So, you know, you can get treated and incarcerated if you go to state prison. So, you know, that's the benefit of state prison.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any
you know, and those are the folks that we found out that treated. So we really want to see, so I don't, you don't have the incarcerated rate, but I think that's something that we were looking at, is making sure those folks don't just get repeatedly tested, you know, and making sure that the providers are checking with their health department to see, does this person have, you know, they'll do a rapid hep C test, and then, you know, they've left and they actually had a history of an RNA test, so they actually are arena. So anyway, I greatly appreciate that, but that's something I want to check in with you about the incarcerated and our cross-jurisdictional, even people who are going to win, and kind of that movement, and see if we can get those folks who are really going to get the treatment. But I appreciate your presentation. I'm just super involved with it. I know how much work that is.
Yeah, thank you so much. And to speak to that, that did come up a couple of times during the investigation. And so there's, I think, Catherine from Alameda County hosts a focus call for different Bay Area counties. And so that has been a way I've been able to connect with folks from different counties. And so when I see any record from like Santa Clara or something, I'll contact the folks at Santa Clara to kind of confirm, oh, is this person like within your jurisdiction? If yes, they're like in the treatment. So, but yeah, coordinating that requires a lot of work.
The people that, I'm sorry, we have Andre next. I also have a question. I'll be able to speak.
Yeah, just you know, I'm probably out here. What drugs do they use? One. And two, since hep C tends to be injected drug use, did you work with people who were still actively using drugs? And then what happened with them?
Yeah, two great questions. Yeah, so previously when hep C treatment was first introduced, it was interferon treatment, which, you know, is like a longer process. Right now, they're typically using Mavrid, Epclusa, and Posebi, I think is the other one. And those are like an 8 to 12 week regime. And it's, I believe it's a once a day or 2 day pill, depending on which medication. And
for how long?
8 to 12 weeks.
Is that what we used? Our body, and that was like a 12-week.
Yes, our body. Yeah, so it's an 8 to 12 week one, and then they'll get tested at the end of 12 weeks, and then another 12 weeks after confirmed cure. And then, yeah, so that was a big part of our population is injection drug users, and so we were working with some folks who did actively inject. And I think that's becoming less of a barrier now than it was in previous years, because I think more folks are moving towards smoking, which is a little less brisk in terms of transmission. And then also I think providers are, there used to be a little more stigma about treating patients who were injection drug users because when they're infected, it's not worth it. And I think now providers are starting to move away from that and still treat folks who are actively using, but also we want to, at least for me, and I think a lot of the other community organizations and like navigators I've talked to there, they support like treating folks and also coupling that with like harm reduction education about transmission and like ways to make injection drug use a little safer in terms of hep C transmission. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, I had a couple questions myself that we're leading. So I noticed definitely sounds like some big challenges in getting that follow-up information. You mentioned that it was possibly due to folks who might be unstably housed. Is that, would you say that was like the main reason that like this fairly large number were just sort of off your map?
It's hard to say because just if folks weren't getting back to me, it's hard for me to know if they weren't responsive to me cold calling them versus like they were unhoused. I forget the exact percentage, but the majority of folks in the second phase that I was not able to get in touch with were unstably housed. So I think there is a connection there. Yeah, and so it was just hard to confirm whether the information I had for them was accurate or not.
Here. My second question was on slide slide 20. I actually looked at the word, I wasn't familiar with the word pyrenic. So does that number, maybe perhaps an insight, does that number mean that they just did not clear? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so viremic means they have an active infection.
Yes.
So that could mean they haven't treated their hep C yet. It could have mean that they have treated, but maybe never went back to get tested to confirm cure. It could mean that they're reinfected. It's just the last record, test record I have is positive.
So multiple reasons.
Why. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Lee.
You actually asked it, which means we're kind of like money, which is
we are. We're excited. any other questions or comments from council members? Any public comment on this presentation? Yes.
It was a great presentation. Thank you. Obviously, housing status has a strong correlation with so many different epidemiology reports, and it has been very difficult for, I think, us as advocates to pin down exactly what unstable house means. Even within city departments, there are different definitions for that. I am curious, you know, what definition was used, what it was, and also how that was reported, whether it was by self-report or they just not have an address, or, you know, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I would argue as an advocate that somebody who is at risk of eviction or in an act of eviction is at unstably housed, but that's not the definition that's used across the board. And so I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. So for the purpose of this project, unstably housed included folks who were staying with a friend, living outdoors or in a vehicle, in treatment or transitional housing, or staying at a shelter. And these statuses were collected from their electronic medical records, if that was recorded there. For hep C community-based testing, we also asked about housing status, so that information is within our registry. So if any of these clients were within our surveillance registry, we didn't have up to date information of it, I pulled it from based off of any community-based testing that they had. And for community-based testing, it's self-reported, like the field.
Mm-hmm. Any more public comment? All right, one more round of applause. Thank you. So we are still ahead of time. I think we'll take a little bit of a longer break now. The food has just arrived, so hold off on rushing to the kitchen until we have that set up for you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember.
No, of course. I was like, glad to look at your Christmas letter. My copy left in.
Yeah, it's okay. It's really.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that that's a really great success.
Yeah,
It's funny, like, you say that, but I feel like you get treated as a business.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know these sentences to tell you stuff. Not just the city.
So I'm Yes, you know, I think that's an
But you'll be checking in that other one. There you go. So I heard it said it like three times, like 20 minutes ago, and it wasn't going to be there, so, but I just verified.
Very good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
All right, we're gonna give up 5 minutes early. So that's it. Manuel and Helen to the front.
Okay.
I don't know if you could reintroduce yourself. I hope we didn't hear you when you first heard it.
Sure. So hi everyone, my name is Manuel Velasquez. I am the HIV Housing Programs Manager with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development today. I will be presenting along with my colleague, Helen Hale.
I'm the Director of Housing Services and Development. HIV Services is under my name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, excited because today we're going to go over, again, housing, which I think seems a very complicated issue for many people. I like to try to break it down. I will say we'll have one area probably in the middle of the presentation for questions, and then any other questions will be. So great. And then if you haven't gotten one, there are some copies of the PowerPoints. I just want to preface this, that we did make a last minute adjustment. There were some revisions we needed to make. So the more accurate version and currently updated is the one that I'll be presenting, but it's also the one that's blueprint. And then I think afterward, I can also email out the updated version just to make sure everyone has the correct information. Because as you know, when you put information out there, we want to make sure you're
done. Anybody welcome?
Okay, so for today's housing presentation, we're going to go over just HIV housing programs in general. Most people are not aware of all the programs in San Francisco, so I'm going to kind of give you an overview of all the different programs and how they're funded, because I think a lot of people hear HOPWA and what that means, they hear general fund, they know what that means. So I'll discuss that as well. I'm also going to discuss the differences between each program, kind of what the service overlay is and what their intention is. And also the referral and application process for each of these programs. Because many of you may know someone, or maybe you're working with someone, and this can be a resource for you. So this PowerPoint is going to be really, really helpful, probably future. So make sure to keep a copy as well. And then also I want to explain the PLUS Housing program. So a lot of people hear about PLUS Housing. We also have made some changes to the PLUS Housing program recently. And so I'll kind of clarify that and go over what the PLUS Housing program is and what the wait list looks like. And then we'll have a little bit of time for questions. So, well, your smartphones, if you're in I try to make this presentation somewhat engaging and interactive, but this is a small, short survey that we're going to do. It's only 3 questions. Okay. So just get your smartphone. I see people already voting. That's great. So the first question is Marin included in San Francisco's eligible metropolitan statistical area, or IMSA? The choices are yes or no. I'll give you like a few more seconds to vote. It's a small group today, which is nice. I'm seeing 7 responses for yes, 4 for no. Okay, so the answer is no, it's not actually included. And I'll explain for that reason, and thank you, Nolly, who's from Marin, but also kind of asked about this question. So specifically, an eligible metropolitan statistical area has certain guidelines with ACWA around how many people are living with the virus in that area or the jurisdiction. So San Francisco and San Mateo is our IMSA for ACWA. And essentially, that looks at everyone who's in those counties who are living with HIV. Marin has very low numbers comparable to San Francisco. And so because of that, so another example, so because of that, the state Office of AIDS is more of the HOPA provider, it's under, and so it's not part of our eligible metropolitan statistical area. They would actually reach out to Marin Housing for any HOPA information. With that being said, another example is like, so as HOPA stands for Housing Opportunity for People with HIV and AIDS. And again, it's based on how many people are living with the virus, and it's on a formula. For instance, Wyoming, which has a lot of rural areas, they don't have a lot of people who are living with HIV in that state. So those kind of states are more for, they're not on the basis of the formula of HMSA, they're more specific to like rural areas. Usually the threshold is about 500,000 people who are usually living in that area, and then also it looks at how many people are living with HIV. So there's a complicated formula a little bit, but more information, I can send that out information too. But just to answer that question, they are not part of our names. Okay, and the second question.
Annual income?
Sorry about this.
Yeah.
Okay. So here we go. Yes. What is the minimum annual income eligibility for a one-person household to receive HIV housing services in San Francisco? Three choices. 30% unadjusted area median income, which is about, for one-person household, is $32,750. 40% unadjusted area median income, which for one-person household is $43,650. Or 50% unadjusted area median income, which is $54,550. So again, this is specific to the HIV in San Francisco. Nationally, the standard is 80% AMI jurisdiction. But and yes, exactly. And I'll go over what that looks like, but it's like $117,000 for one person household. As you can imagine, we don't have a lot of money to go around. We don't have a lot of services. So it makes it extremely competitive for people who are very vulnerable to have to compete within an 80% AMI. So here in San Francisco, we follow our unadjusted area median income that's set by MOCD. And that, again, reduces the competition for people to get services. But in general, HOPA eligibility is 80% AMI. You know, so we also understand that, too. Yes. The answer is 50% AMI. So yes, 50% AMI is the threshold we try to keep people at. And again, that's $54,450 for one person household. And so anything from that below is what we usually prioritize for services at most of these. Okay. And number three, how are Plus housing applicants selected for unit referral and placement? It looks like people said lottery. Yes, you're correct. The other options were first come, first serve, medical need, and lowest income. Waitlist management is very challenging, as you can imagine, being able to decide who gets services over other people. And so, again, we provide a lottery, which is done at random for people. Now, there is an exception to that in a sense where people who are at care facilities, I'll go over the TRCFs and RCFCIs, I'll explain what that means. Those people are prioritized because a lot of them don't really have a lot of income. Many of them don't have family supports or other supports and have lost their housing. So they really have nowhere to go, and they're usually coming out of medical fragility. So we really try to prioritize them. So there's kind of a medical need there, but that's also listed in the Plus Housing website and also in the Housing Authority's administrative tab. Okay. I hope that was fun. HIV housing programs in San Francisco. So as I kind of just mentioned, I'm going to go more in depth. I won't read everything in the slide, but for someone to be eligible for HIV housing services, they have to be low income. So again, our threshold maximum is 50%. I put 80% here because that is the national standard. But again, understanding that 80% AMI for a one-person household is $117,700. Anyone who makes that much and below as a one-person household is technically eligible for HOPA. Again, because every jurisdiction of HOPA can kind of based on the needs of the community, can change eligibility a little bit to make sure it's specific to that population. So we do have that here, and it's in our policies. For Plus housing locally, as I mentioned, it is the 50% unadjusted area. Proof of HIV status, this is pretty standard, a letter of diagnosis. And then also for HOPA programs, they must live in San Francisco. We do have programs that are not funded by HOPA, so I'm going to point that out. And also a lot of our PLUS housing services are not funded by HOPA. So we actually can provide services to people who are outside of the jurisdiction for those types of services. But for HOPA, like our tenant-based rental assistance and some other programs I'll mention, those have to be in San Francisco. Current OCD funded programs, so I kind of broke them down into categories. So we have tenant-based rental subsidies, and this is similar to like a Section 8, where it's long-term rental subsidies, but I'll go over all the subsidy programs we have. We have some that are a little different. Housing legal support services, we have a legal referral panel. Thank you so much for all the work y'all do. Permanent supportive housing, so we have Derek Silva, 20 Franklin Street, which is a permanent supportive housing program. And then we have transitional housing programs. This would include our care facilities. I'll go over those in a second, as well as the RCFCI and the RCFs. Project-based units. So I do want to mention, this is kind of where PLUS comes in, where we do unit placement. I'll kind of talk about it a little more later. But essentially, project-based subsidies. So subsidies that are tied to the actual building or the project, project being the key word there, as opposed to a tenant-based subsidy where it follows the tenant. So those are the keywords to keep in mind. We have approximately 450 units throughout the city that are project-based, meaning the HOPA subsidy or the type of support assistance is located in that unit, stays with that unit. So we have approximately 450 of those with varying departments across the city. So some are funded with COC money, which is continuum of care, that's with HSH. Some are funded with OCD TBRA subsidies and project-based subsidies. So we have a various amounts of subsidies, but there are 450 throughout the city. And when units become vacant, they usually contact OCD and they ask for a referral. And then based on the community and the needs of that community, eligibility-wise, I usually will work through the PLUS housing list, through the lottery, to select households that are eligible. And then we make a referral. It's very rare that these units come open because a lot of people stay in them for a long time. The housing board is also a partner. So a good example is Derek Silva. It's a 68-bed facility, and it has all Section 8 except for two units, but all of them are project-based Section 8 units. So they get Housing Authority Section 8 assistance with the HOPA designation. So a person has to be here. Okay, now I'm going to hand it over to my colleague.
Good evening, I guess. Really good evening now. Today has moved forward. So I wanted to go a little bit through. There has been some questions about HOPA and HIV services at OCD. And I wanted to sort of share with you sort of how the funding works and what the different programs are, because we have lots of different funding sources in our allocation. And it's not all HOPA, so it's not all federal. So as you can see in fiscal year 25-26, we had the 7 million and change. And then this year, we, first time in multiple years, that we have received an increase. Of that increase, because San Mateo is part of our jurisdiction, they receive part of the money that comes for San Francisco. And so I broke out the increase so that you all could understand sort of how that works. So the San Francisco portion is $6,495,292. So the increase is about 290,027. And of that, an administrative allowance, which means any kind of staffing or different pieces that we have within San Francisco, that's up to that amount is how much we can use. Okay, there's a button. Okay. In general, our funding for HIV housing, so you can see that I have shifted away from just HOPA, and I'm now telling you the broader spectrum of the services that we have here. So the total funding is $8,385,915. Of that, these are the grant awards only. So then you have the HOPA amount that's there at the end of the day. You all can see this and read it. Yes, okay, great. And you can see that we have general fund and housing trust fund. So So the general fund and housing trust fund is money that we have allocated toward HIV services to offset in years where we may have had some kind of indication of either less reduction. So we don't want our HIV service providers to be defunded or to have to reduce what they're doing. In my entire area of housing services, I work as the director very hard in being very clear to the administration or to supervisors, it doesn't matter who it is, that all of the work that is funded under my grant portfolios all has to do with displacement of folks. And so any kind of change to that system will only trickle people into the homeless world. For HIV services, I'm also talking about complex health issues. And so I'm extremely protective of HIV services. So as an example, when we had the mega RFP we dropped it in 24, and it was for the 25-26, HIV did not receive any cuts whatsoever. And in addition, as an example, in ALF case here. So you probably have heard, and then you heard this year about community-based services for the mayor's office. But at one point, legal services was something that was recommended to us to get rid of. No longer serve. Don't jump into why you should have done that. General civil legal. So I moved ALRP over under HIV services to protect them, because I didn't want them to be part of the plan, because I know how important any kind of general civil legal services is for HIV folks. So there's a lot of sort of behind the scenes third work done in terms of my part. I'm not suggesting, because I do have providers here, that the amount of money that I give you is enough to be able to support you at the level that you should be getting, but I'm working with a certain amount of money that I have. But in doing so, we have designated both general fund dollars. So when we're asked to cut general fund dollars by the mayor's office, for instance, HIV is not on the table, and they have to come through me. So I think most folks in our department just sort of navigate away. And the housing trust fund is money that came through a different proposition that was passed, and it's used in support of keeping folks stably housed. And so because this work under me is primarily around stability for housing, I've been able to navigate almost $500,000 of housing trust fund money into HIV services, which is not something that the mayor's office necessarily can tell us to reduce or move away from. So I tried to create and add funding into here. A large portion of, as you can see, of the general fund that's in there has to do with the money that you all in the advocacy community advocated for to support our general fund subsidy program. So that's where that general fund is there, because you all advocated for it. And so that's where that money's coming from. In addition, we also have housing trust fund. So the top section up here is talking about our general fund, kind of based on a subsidy program, and the services supported for it. Then the next layer here is the care facilities, both different types of care facilities, and the money and how that is being supported there. And you can see that we've added some general fund in. That was the amount that would have had to have gone away for the last RFP. And so, like I said, we moved general fund into it. And then transitional housing services, those are, there's San Mateo's. And then we have our Randy Work, which is funded by HOPWA. And then we have our general legal services and then both are Arizona. But there we go. Okay. Something that's not talked about a lot out in the world in terms of grant funding is we actually run a Section 8 program for HIV folks that is kind of based around subsidies, very much like Section 8, except for the fact that the person has to have, someone in the household has to have an HIV diagnosis. So that is a program that is staffed and run by MOCD and is funded by HOPWA that comes in. We can't use local funds for that, because it's in fact a part of a federally funded process. And if I were to move to have general fund, it would just contribute to the federal government reducing our allocation for subsidies throughout the federal subsidies. So it's run very much like it. We have an eligibility specialist, we have financial staff that cut checks to landlords. We actually have to, on an annual basis, enter into a new contract with those landlords Most of those landlords try to ask for rather large rent increases on a regular basis, and we hold them pretty tight. But that means that every single year for the folks that are in the subsidy programs, we have an increased cost. It doesn't matter how we go about doing it, we have an increased cost. Plus, what we also have is we have a number of our recipients are older now, and many of them may be living in beautiful San Francisco buildings that have the walk-up with four flights, but at some point, walking up four flights is probably not healthy or safe for folks to be living independently. So we do get a lot of reasonable accommodations from folks asking to have some support to be able to move them to someplace else. But that does also, their first home may have been a rent-controlled unit, but likely that where they're trying to move to is not a rent-controlled unit, so that immediately brings the cost up for their monthly rent to much higher than they themselves would be able to pay for, so our subsidy increases. So it is a very variable, and it is over time we have seen a substantial amount of increases with regards to the tenant-based rental subsidy program. In addition, households themselves, they have to do let us know when their income changes, and as the older folks get, they get more and more closer to a fixed income. And so you do see a reduction of the income that they have there. As you can see, part of the reason that this got updated is because we track starting in April around what our expected costs will be going forward for the next year and sort of over time evolve. So this is what our projected increase this year is currently for just to run that program alone, which as you can see, it's more than the amount of money that came in for the increased cost for this year. And this is what we're on track to actually have right for this current year for 25-26. And then here in general, so just for you to understand, so within HOPLA, we have the grants, then we have our tenant-based rental subsidy program, we have our staffing and administration, the total comes to that, and you can see that the projected gap for this year is going to be $23,000, which is better than it has been in other years, but it is still, we still have to figure out how we are going to get to that number. And then there's our local funding sources. So our current services for this year is going to be $12,381,089. So we're incredibly committed to ensuring that the programs that we currently fund remain funded. And we look for every opportunity to make sure that we have a very secure funding available to support our HIV services. This is one of these populations that's very near and dear to my heart, so not gonna happen. And as an example, so we have, the mayor's office did restore legal services to funding amounts back to our mega RFP is. And so we will be, it was my task, legal services for a lot of the programs under me, but the legal services is also under me. And so for instance, ALRP is going to be getting an additional amount of money this year. So the amount they had last year and going forward will increase. So there will be more money available for ALRP to support HIV folks. So we are looking every day and trying to make sure that our HIV folks are covered. Is it enough? No, it's not. So any amount of support that you all give when you advocate on behalf of HIV services, we're super grateful. We are working super closely with DPH and DOS. We started a really strong relationship with DOS so that we can make sure that all the senior programs that are out there, that those service providers are very educated around HIV services. So we're doing a lot of cross training and trying to make sure that every touch point that could connect with someone with HIV is actually the folks that are providing services are knowledgeable and they can connect with where they need to be. I think we're going to pause here, mainly because my husband, well, I'm also a caregiver for, because he's quite older than I am, wondering where I might be. So if I can take questions around, he's fine, but he's like, what? So I want to make sure he gets dinner. Important. So I was wondering if we have any questions about the budget now. I'm sorry that that's not in a better order, but I mean, I can wait till the end, but we'd better.
Sure. So the mayor announced an increase in the
city's annual affordable housing trust fund contribution. Is that that the program?
That's a different pot.
Yeah.
There's several pots. So affordable housing. So just underneath, I have eviction prevention. I have all of HOMSF and RAD, which is former public housing, all of those service providers and that kind of work. We're very close to the HSH. I have HIV services. I also have tenant advocacy and counseling, that education counseling, that folks, all of that work under the rest of my career. And legal services is sitting with my team as well. So I do know a lot about how housing is built and all of that. So unfortunately, it's very expensive to build housing in San Francisco. And so we have created different types of propositions that have gone before voters to be able to put us to do the set aside, to be able to make sure that any building that we're building, that there are certain units. So that was what we were referring to a little bit with the 450. So just to give you a little more background around that, some of those units were actually built, or a building was rehabbed with some HOPWA dollars, but there's no actual HOPWA dollars going into subsidizing the unit. So in some cases, we do have an overlay with the housing authority, but even in the cases where we don't, because we've used HOPWA at some point, or we designated the units for HIV folks, we require the owner to only accept 30% of folks' income to be able to have them meet that. So we've really intentionally, Manuel and I worked really hard to ensure that we have units in new buildings, in new affordable buildings that come on board that are designated for HIV. Every time we successfully help our colleagues in our office understand the vulnerability of the population, so that when we have a new building come on board, there are usually up to about 5 units designated for HIV. Which is really important from my perspective, because I feel like for many of the folks, they go to units that are accessible or have an elevator at the very end. And so I want them in safe housing. The accelerator fund is going to help identify so we can move the pipeline along. The current pipeline that we have is moving much more slowly than we wanted to. So when we did the last 5-year plan, we had hoped to be able to get 50 units online. By the time we do the next one, it's very unlikely that we'll get to that because we just haven't been able to build the building. Housing Trust Fund is an earlier version that's money, but it also, some of that money goes toward buildings, but some of the money is actually designated to support like housing services. And so, like a lot of my HOPSF and RAD and housing services, buildings that never had services before anywhere in San Francisco, now get some housing trust fund to be able to make sure that our most vulnerable folks actually have someone. And the goal of the on-site services, this is true of our HIV also, is we want to connect people to the larger social service safety net. But we want to make sure those social service safety net folks also come on site if it's appropriate. To be able to deliver some services where people are at, as opposed to having so much travel across town. That's probably more than you wanted. Yes.
No, it's great. Thank you.
That's right.
So, is any HOPWA funding going into the development of new units at this point?
So, the current units that are in the pipeline, there is no HOPWA funding because capital has almost been depleted to nothing. But I am confident to let you know that it is a priority in our department, and we're making sure that HIV units are designated and working with our owners to make sure that they have an operating budget that can sustain a number of units and at the 50% of people's income, you know, which will vary according to how much people have. A lot of times we will also use, we will need to use like a general fund subsidy to help a person just get in, like qualify in a new building because there's a minimum amount of income, but then their rent will be calculated based on their income.
So you have the ability to dedicate units for HIV only without putting any HOPWA dollars into it, just making that determination yourself as part of the development.
We have prioritized HIV as a population that needs attention in our affordable housing portfolio, yes.
Thank you.
You have to be very careful how you say that from a fair housing perspective. The legal,
that's
legal folks here are cringing at what I'm saying. But yeah, I trust that we will not rush out and say we're breaking the law. We're not breaking the law. What we're trying to do is ensure that a population that may not be reached by our Dahlia lottery actually has an opportunity to apply for units. Because in the past, when we looked both at different races, but also different types of folks with different kinds of challenges, that they are not folks that generally apply because they feel as if those units wouldn't be for them because I don't have enough money.
Right, and that, I mean, my question is because in years past, we were often told unless HAPL money was used in the development of the unit, it could not be dedicated as a HAPL only. So I'm happy to hear that that is no longer the case, given that no HAPL money is really going into capital at this point.
We don't have the capital funds available any longer. And I think there are a number of those 450 that was HAPL. The other little tricky thing about HAPL is that at some point, it's basically 10 years, at some point when you've used HAPL, after 10 years, they can, in theory, no longer require the unit to be HIV. We have worked very hard to make sure that on our loans, that we do not designate it 10 years, but actually for the life of the loan, and that it will be re-upped. And so there's a lot of work on our part, Manuel's and my part, in educating our colleagues around the importance of it's great to give a resource to folks, but not to take it away. And particularly for any population that is vulnerable, that taking things away is a promise broken, and that for this department, we cannot break those kind of promises.
Can you say, so the it is extremely exciting that we've got an actual increase in funding this year. I'm very appreciative of all the folks who've been advocating at the federal level around this. Can you say a little bit more about how the increase is getting spent? Because it sounded like it's getting sort of swallowed up by landlord raising rent.
In general, every year we have to basically negotiate for 160 federal vouchers, basically negotiate the amount. What is the market rate amount? And it goes up pretty significantly every single year. Actually, our staffing portion each year, less and less of the city staff are being paid for out of HAPL, and more money is going just generally to maintain those vouchers. The vouchers that we had, when we first started, when the program first came to us, the program was managed by Housing Authority, HSA,
redevelopment agency.
It
was all redevelopment agency when it started,
right.
and then
it came to us. And what year?
2018.
Yeah, it takes a lot of, hard for me to remember now. In general, we had about 175, something like that, 180 something. And in general, there has been, things have fallen off because people in general have passed away. However, what Manuel and I work very hard to do is to keep a few of the vouchers available for complex or very serious circumstances where we feel as if having them have to move, for instance, would only complicate their health, those kinds of things. So we do actually have some at each year. We're losing in the vicinity of about 15 or so a year, so you can see it's only dropped down about 15, and it's been since 2018. We've obviously maintained and added some folks. But in general, all of the increase this year is going to go toward landlord increases, people moving to new units where people are moving away from their current unit, which in many cases, people are rent control units. And when they move, they're moving to an affordable unit or they're moving, they can take their voucher and go to a market rate owner. And the amount of subsidy then skyrockets up. So that's primarily where most of that increase is going to go to. It's unfortunately more expensive than we want it to be.
And so in the past, you've just been, it sounds like, covering this through attrition, right, as people die?
We covered some of it through attrition, but we have also, that's part of the reason that we've increased housing trust fund and we've done other things. We put other money into our grants so that we can free up more of the HOPPA money to be able to support this. Otherwise, in fairness, we would have to end subsidies, and that's just, our fiscal team does come to me on a pretty regular basis and said, make sure you need to have everybody remain on this. They don't come to me very much anymore because they know the answer is pretty much no. One of the things they said to me when there was conversation about how we were spending our money was they said, happy to put HIV back into the bucket so we can reduce their allocation each year. And I went, that is not what anyone is intending. And so I just need you to back up. They have questions. It's important to answer questions. It's fine. But we're not changing how we manage HIV under any circumstance. So that this is what, you know, because it's hard when we sit in a room with other directors, and there's another director that runs the community-based services, and this year they took all of the cut. Nothing was cut in my program at all. And, you know, everyone sort of ends up having a lot of conversation about how we manage that. I'm like, keeping people housed. I don't want the other ones cut either. I want to be very clear. I don't support any of the cuts, period. And I'm eternally grateful to everybody that's working to get things done. Just as an example, all of my staff managed all the transgender and all of those contracts too under community-based services. So we're very much watching to see what happens.
Yeah, so then my next question is actually about HUD and HUD changing requirements and regulations, speaking of trans folks. To what extent are you, and I apologize because I'm just not as, I see some of the HUD stuff, but not as much as I see the CDC and in-person stuff. To what extent are you getting letters from HUD with new requirements or new restrictions or new policies from this administration that would potentially harm our ability to house people with HIV and people at highest risk of HIV? And what is the city's response done? And if this is too long of a question,
no, it's not. I've answered it over and over again. So part of my role, I work very closely with the Housing Authority because other parts of my portfolio are directly connected to project-based vouchers and a bunch of things with the Housing Authority. So I'm very aware of the EHB and also the mixed status families, all of those things that have come out that are horrible. So the EHB that came out of, it makes sense that you all want to know this, so I'm just going to answer it. So the EHB. Thank you. Emergency housing vouchers that are distributed through HSH, and they were on a 10-year cycle, but it's been cut short. And by end of October, people will lose their subsidies. So currently, MoCD and the Housing Authority are working with our community providers to make sure that anyone that has an EHB will have a soft landing, and that we will either, I think you've seen that the mayor put aside some money also to make sure that we are able to move people into housing. I think one of the challenging things about that is some of the EHB providers are porting their vouchers outside of San Francisco. And so if the voucher's still in San Francisco, that's helpful to us, but we wouldn't be able to send San Francisco money someplace else. So that's a bigger conversation. We're working household by house. I would strongly recommend, and I'll leave some cards with Manuel, but if you know of folks or people are reaching out to you, you're always welcome to reach out to me, and I'm happy to connect them to the right folks to be able to support that. So that's one set of groups. The mixed status families. So for our HAPWA and HUD funded, San Francisco does not report citizenship status at all. It's not collected in any of our data, and it will be. During the first administration, all of my email communication was, you heard the rumors of people's emails being frozen and so that you couldn't get rid of anything. So I did look through that first round, and I'm the current person at MoCD that is managing mixed status, so that should they want to do the same thing again, that I can have all of that frozen. We generally don't talk about status by email or anything. We do everything by phone. Within our programs, for us, we are tenant-based rental subsidy under HOPWA. I do not have anybody that is under big status, which we moved them when it needs to be elected into a different type of subsidy, and made sure that it remained fully satisfied the way that it was, so that they wouldn't be at risk. We also have some HOPWA units in San Francisco that you mentioned that don't have a project-based doctor, so therefore they're not at risk, and those are basically kept for families that have a mixed status circumstance. So we are looking very carefully and making sure and trying our best. Will it be perfect? No. But we are trying to make sure that anybody that by no fault of their own should not be lose their subsidies, that we can have a soft landing for them. So we were able to identify some extras through our city, our home. I have some senior disabled increases this year for the general fund that will be there. So if we don't have it for HIV and the HIV pool, then we'll tap into the senior disabled. That's who's working with telling me that I'm not.
No, I appreciate that. I still have a few more slides to go, so I appreciate the question. Lee, we'll go with yours, and I will say, if anybody else has any additional questions, I will be emailing out this PowerPoint with also some follow-up information from the formula and some of that, and please compile, because Helen will be on that email, and she can also answer them too.
I'm happy to help with a client, or if you yourself or your staff have questions, I'm trying to be responsive. The best way to communicate with me is via email, but if it's a mixed status, please call me.
So this is more of a comment in terms of how the demographic of HIV is headed. We're going to end up with the majority of cases of people that are seniors with HIV. And this program is so incredibly important because as people age, their medical need is going to increase, and the access and all that kind of stuff is going to be critically important. So I just appreciate your work.
Yeah, that's part of the reason that we worked for the better with DOS,
yes,
to make sure that there was connection, and we're creating a very strong safety net. Within my team in general, I value collaboration across departments and making sure that we're very aware of what the social service safety net is, so that folks don't fall through the cracks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go through the rest of the slides. Again, it's a little short on time, so I just want to kind of go through this. I'm not going to go into detail. So essentially, I just wanted to run some numbers. It's that time of the year again where we look at our program data and see how many clients we served in the year, what our service utilization is like, and things of that nature. So this is just kind of a breakdown of some of the numbers. So as you can see, within our care facilities, our residential care facility for chronically ill, and our transitional residential care facilities, placement and exit number. So we had a total of 60 admissions to our RCFCIs, which is great for the year. And then we have two RCFCIs. We had three TRCFs, and amongst those, there was 35. And then exits, we had 43 people exit an RCFCI, which is really good news. That means they helped to stabilize them. And then we also have 29 TRCF exits. And so again, transitional residential care facilities, they can stay there for 2 years, RCFCIs for one. So it's interesting to see the numbers of how people move forward, but I'm really excited with the exit numbers that's increased over the years, and it means that we're really helping people to get housed. There's dedicated housing navigation when a person exits, and there's a lot of planning that goes into that, and we have successfully gotten people on a subsidy. We've successfully gotten people into a project-based unit, so it's been really helpful. Thank you. For Plus Housing, we had a total of 202 applicants just in this fiscal year, and for subsidized unit placement, so again, I only get the call whenever someone usually passes away or moves out of the jurisdiction. So that doesn't happen that often, but we had 49 people that we were able to place amongst those units. Mm-hmm. And again, that's kind of like a golden ticket, as Helen mentioned, it's like a Section 8 project-based unit where a person will only pay 30% of income. Total number served so far this year, and we still have a few more days left in June, 561. So amongst our rental subsidies, we currently provide 396 rental subsidies. We have permanent supportive housing. We have 59 of those that were served this year. So there are some vacant units that we're trying to fill. Transitional housing, 16, and care facilities, 9. So I think that's really great. Last year, for reference, it's about 506. So we are increasing the number of people that we're serving every year. how to refer a client. So I kind of mentioned eligibility information at the beginning. Most of this is kind of information that you probably already know, but HIV letter diagnosis. At the time of enrollment, your person will have to show their income eligibility. So I usually tell people to get 2 to 3 months worth of bank statements and then the most recent paycheck stub or the most recent benefit award letter, so from the last month. I will also put this out there. So I'm a person living with HIV. I've been a client of many of our services and our programs in San Francisco, and I take very much a lot of pride and a lot of responsibility in my role. And I will say we're a low barrier to access to the service, okay? So if a person, for instance, a person's doing massage work or they're doing whatever they are to get income, we will also take a self-attestation. We're not going to be so, you know, cut and dry and us fit in the black and white experience. We really try to meet people where they're at and be low barrier to access. I think some of you can attest to that if you work with me, but we really also try to make our policy that way as well. So these are contact points of contact for each of the programs that we provide offline and HIV services for. So we have our tenant-based rental assistance. Again, this is a great slide. You can take a picture with your phone, or like I said, I'll be sending this out. But I usually tell people to print this slide out because this is a great point of contact. You get the email, you get the phone number for all of our different programs here.
Okay.
Yes,
it's in there.
It's in there too, but yeah. I mean, you never know. I take pictures of my phone just so I can have it. It's always there.
Thank you.
Of course. So this is a brief overview. Again, we're running out on time, so I'm not going to go into all of it. But again, these are our permanent and transitional housing facilities. So as I mentioned, Derek Silva is at 20 Franklin Street right here. Mercy Housing is the owner of the building, and Catholic Charities provides the services on site. So that is permanent supportive housing. We have Brandy Morehouse, which is our transitional supportive housing facility here in the Western Addition. It's 11 units. It's geared towards people of color and also people who are coming out of incarceration, people who are coming out of treatment. This is a really good landing place. And so people are able to be there as well. They're provided supportive case management, rehabilitation for work, and also if they want to go back to school, support around that as well. Now we have our rental subsidies and supportive services. So as Helen mentioned, our TBRA program, or tenant-based rental assistance, is a long-term subsidy similar to Section 8, where everyone on this program only pays 30% of their income towards rent per month. And then we have our tiered subsidy program. So this program is general funded. So when I say that, it's good because it's less restrictive, right? COPPA is a federal program, so there are regulations and standards we have to follow. Whereas a general fund program, locally funded program, we can kind of create more of our own policies, and it's a little more loose. And in that respect, we wanted to be a good steward of this program's money, the general funds. So instead of saying everyone gets like a standard percentage of how much they pay for its rent, we want to meet people where they're at, right? Because some people need a lot of help and some people need a little bit of help. So it's called tiered subsidy because the case person who works with the intake and enrollment, when they meet someone, they'll assess what they realistically can afford in terms of rent, their budget, food, things like that. We'll go, well, we won't have a little time for that activity, but I did give you all that. I'll go over it in a second. But we then they'll determine, can they be at 30%, they be at 40%, or 50% of a contribution towards their rent. So if the money goes by longer, rather than just saying everyone gets 30% of their income towards rent, if that makes sense. Then we have our Second Star program. This is the competitive spends program, a special project of national significance with HUD. Catholic Charities is the service provider. We are the grantee at MOCD, and this is a very unique competitive program. It's been around for several years. But it's a program that's given partial subsidy for people who are trying to go back to work or trying to go back to school. And then we have ALRP, it's Legal Referral Panel. Supportive services. They provide free legal assistance for persons living with HIV and a plethora of housing benefits, employment, family. Right. Now we have our care facilities. So I mentioned residential care facility for chronically ill, or RCFCI. That is a state licensed facility. So they also have a licensure in the state of California that they have to follow regulations. These facilities are usually more expensive to run, because they really are meant for medically fragile individuals who need assisted daily living, nursing, medication management. They have a lot more staff on site. They provide 3 meals a day. MyTree is one of them, and also Peter Claver. So we're very grateful for our RCFCIs. And then we have our transitional residential care facilities. They used to be RCFCIs, but again, because HOPWA has not really gone up, the allocation, and a lot of these programs rely on HOPWA funding, they said, how can we run these programs more affordably without having to close doors and things like that? So most CD actually brought in a consultant. We did a strategic assessment of all of them, and we found that 50% of the people that were currently in those programs didn't really need that level of service. So we actually created a step down called the Transitional Residential Care Facility. And it's really meant to help someone stabilize. They provide like kind of independent living classes, if you will, like how to cook, how to manage your budget. They do vocational support and behavioral health and mental health services on site. It's really a wraparound. And again, after 2 years, a person is working with a housing navigator to find independent housing. And again, as I mentioned, these exits from these facilities are prioritized in terms of unit placement before law. Because again, we recognize the fragility and how much they've achieved. And I will say we've had a lot of success. I mean, historically, and there are some people in this room that know, before we made this change, it was like a bottleneck. We had wait lists at all the facilities. People really couldn't get in that really need those beds. And as I said, 50% of the people didn't really need those beds. But because of housing scarcity and lack of income, they had to stay there. So it became institutionalization. So we in OCD said there's got to be a change. And so again, we put all this in action with the community. I presented to many of you, locked arms and gone through it, but it's been great. So now we have a really good outcome. I think it's a really good care standard. Plus housing wait list, real quickly. So the wait list used to be for anyone who was HIV positive in San Francisco who was in need of housing assistance. And I, in my role of kind of the coordinator, I'm the kind of point of contact. Essentially, people would reach out to me and I would refer them to a housing subsidy. So the San Francisco AIDS Foundation is a great community partner. Their programs, their housing programs are funded through general funds. So they also have their own programs over there. We used to make referrals to them. Now we kind of cut out the middle person, if you will. And so we no longer have to require me doing the placement for a referral to a subsidy. We actually have a dedicated website that has all HIV or all actually rental subsidy providers in the entire city that are not even specific to HIV. So if a person is trying to call around, they can kind of figure out where they want to go. They can do the work. It cuts me out, just, takes the responsibility to hold up on me and gives it the power of the person to kind of take action for their own house. Also, case managers can make phone referrals. But before, it was all through me. So you can imagine, it's like hundreds of people. And it's a lot. So again, we think that's an improvement, honestly. And now people also feel informed. Like beforehand, it's like, how do I get on the subsidy? What is the term? Now they can actually reach out to the provider and get those questions answered rather than the program's changed, right? And that's kind of the one person that's supposed to keep it all together. And I'm a dedicated community partner, but this really helps take out that barrier. We're like, trying to reduce barriers. And it kind of goes over eligibility, but now we're focused on unit placement. So, anyone who's applied for Plus Housing going forward, they will be put into a lottery, and they will be selected from that into a unit placement. Just an example, and I want to kind of take a little story here real quickly. So Helen mentioned how we're working with other departments to decrease barriers. HSH, a lot of people have heard this. They've had a hard time filling some of their HOPWA units. Because they haven't had all the different eligibility that they require. Many people have reached out to me because these units have gone vacant for a while. I've been able to build a bridge, it's still a bridge in the works, with HSH to help them improve their coordinated entry and ensure that they're prioritizing people who are HIV positive for their places. So when a person who's homeless is not prioritized from HSH or coordinated entry, they will apply. We have approximately 500 people who identify as homeless in our waitlist. And essentially, they'll be put in the lottery. And so we have actually, just last week, I called a two-person household that was living in their car and said, you now have a Section 8 project-based unit, essentially. And they're going to be housed. And I can tell you how rewarding that is, but that's just one of many. I also have people who are in difficult situations, but they're staying in them because they don't have a lot of options. This has been a big resource for me. So, and again, 48, 49 placements from the current, from the previous slide, that's how many people have been in place. That's really good. I think last year it was like more closer to 15. So it's been an increase. And as Helen mentioned, we are really trying to dedicate and advocate for people who are HIV positive. Helen mentioned when it comes time for funding, It is interesting, and a person living with HIV, I try not to get offended, but people do ask me, why is HOPWA still important? Like, in the developer world, like real estate, brick and mortar people. And I have to explain to them, this is the life to death situation for many people. Housing is healthcare. You know, a person, their house stably, they can improve their health. And that's important for all of us, right? That's important for our larger community. And so I actually do have to educate, as Colin said, our colleagues. Many colleagues are HIV ignorant. They don't know what it means. And so I actually reach out there. I tell them I'm HIV positive. And then I go over the life cycle. I can do all these different things. And I do. And they actually appreciate the information. I think a lot of people are just scared to talk about it. Interesting enough, it's still stigmatized. But in the housing world, we put that front and center. I live very openly as an HIV positive person in my office. I may not be the smartest or the most professional, but I have a big heart for HIV positive people, and I'm part of this community for a reason. So I want y'all to know that, and that's how we're making improvements. And again, my position, I help create strategic plans with your input. I remain a committed partner. You know, I want us to see this in the city rather than it being hierarchical or someone who's not HIV positive telling us what it is.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
That part of it. So you have 500 people for them who have said that they're homeless, but coordinated entry did not,
yeah,
like they didn't rank high enough on coordinated entry, so they come. You?
It's not all of them. So, you know, they self-identify. So, if people got applications and they're homeless, but I would say a lot of times I'm hearing feedback from people who are calling me, because most of the time they fill an application online and then they only get selected and not all. But I do get people who will call me saying, I'm homeless. I went to HIV, I wasn't prioritized. I'll then tell them, please fill out a plus out the application. I'll explain to them. And then I also give them RCFCI and TRCI information. Because that's probably the most immediate way to get housing. Leland House is going to open 20 more beds very soon. And they just recreated their facility. It's really beautiful. We just did a tour. And they have like a little kitchen that they do our cook and stuff like that. We're making a progress, everyone. Like 7 years ago, when I took this position, this was like a dream. And so we're really achieving it. But yeah, so essentially those are self-identified positive people. And yeah, I mean, essentially what they do get selected and identify as homeless. I will have to say, did you go through coordinated entry first? Because you have a dedicated
yes.
support company. Tell us like commission. But essentially, we're all in this, right? And again, if you're not prioritized, they still need help. So I'll explain all their options. The first question is also, where are you getting HIV care? Because we understand you partners with providers, and medical housing, it's important to be holistic.
So HSH has HOPWA units that they control who gets referred to them.
Because they have COC subsidy.
And about how many of them do you think are vacant at any given time?
I just got an email today, Laura, to be honest with you. I was contacted by Mission Housing who said we have this unit at this specific place that has been vacant for a while. And I reached out to HSA and many other ones, all those individuals, and they're like, oh, we're going to take care of it. A lot of times they'll say that they don't fit our chronic homeless message, like if I'm making a referral or something. And so I'm like, they still need to be served. And so I work with those providers to figure out like how they can help to get more rapport, help how they can get a list of people who might be eligible. We're now working, I think I mentioned at the previous meeting that I've put out a request for OCD, the Plus Housing Program, to be a community access partner, right? Where we can actually help people kind of get through the assessment and identify them for prioritization. So I hope that answers your question.
Sort of. I mean, it's, and this isn't the.
I'm sorry, I do want to point out that we have less than 10 minutes left, and about 7 slides and an announcement.
Got it. So just to name the problem, like
yeah.
People who are unhoused are going to court, people who are unhoused and living with HIV are going through the coordinated entry system. They are not like scoring high enough, even though they're unhoused and HIV positive, to get into one of the vacant HOPWA HIV dedicated units that HSH is gatekeeping. Right. And you, meanwhile, have a list with like potentially 500 unhoused HIV positive people, none of whom are able to get into that unit. So that this is not a problem. This is a us problem. I'm just, yeah.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I want to be mindful of time. Thank you. These are great questions. Okay, well, I won't go over the case study then. But essentially, the case study was meant, usually when I have a lot more time, I'll usually bring up this case study. You all have what's called the housing needs assessment in front of you. This is a really helpful tool. Please take this back to you and your colleagues, make copies. But it kind of walks you through the process of housing navigation for any home. So essentially, at the top, you can see it asks for what's their monthly maximum rent that they're thinking of. They ask about their previous and their current communities, like where they enjoy, where they not enjoy. So that helps you place them correctly or help more sustainably. And the challenges they perceive in the future, maybe they money management, maybe they've been evicted. Thank you. You know, if you tell me that, I can help you kind of get connected to services. And then service animals and things like that. So this is really helpful. I'm not going to go into the differences because I kind of explain RCFCI and TRCF differences. This is really helpful though to take in the process. As Molly can attest to, we want a complete application when it's sent in, and here's all the information. And then I did want to shout out these new units. So y'all heard Helen mention, we put this in the strategic plan. We are gonna meet this goal. We have some units that are being built. The first will be 1515 South NS. They've already actually started construction, and they'll be in lease up in 2027. And we're actually developing the lottery process to match with our BMR program. So for instance, when they place people through a lottery, if many of you apply for BMR or Dahlia, you get win a lottery, and then you get a certificate of preference. We're now creating a certificate of preference for positive heat. What about that? And so they can actually not note that. They will be prioritized when lotteries come up because there's now an HIV positive certificate of preference.
Wow.
Want to clap on that?
Yeah,
that was actually a big deal. Our city attorney kind of
yeah.
So anyway, these are all the units that are coming up. And again, these will be placed through the lottery or through our CFCI exits, depending. Questions, please, you know, they have my contact information. And with that, I think I'm going to make the announcement. So it's been a pleasure to serve with all of you for the last several years. I'm not going to be reviewing my application. I am resigning from the planning council. But I'm not going to be a stranger. I'll definitely come around and still present and be a part of the body. But at this time, I just felt that resigning would be the best thing for me right now. Everything I got going on in my life, personally and professionally. I still love the work. I'm still a very dedicated individual. And again, I still remain a committed partner. So I'm happy to come and talk, come in here and provide public comment. Happy to do that. But I just want to tell you all again, the person with HIV who's been in the community has seen the work that this body does and all of our advocates. I'm extremely grateful. I mean that very genuinely. Why we really didn't do it, it takes a village. It's not just one person or one organization. It really takes a village. So thank you all so much for your collegialism and your support of this.
We do have 4 minutes for the additional question, but I have three things I wanted to mention before that. First of all, just a thank you to Manuel. Manuel will continue to appear before the council, hopefully on an annual basis, to provide housing updates. Also, I just want to thank Manuel for almost instantly stepping into a leadership role as soon as they got on the council, and has just been very helpful all along. The second thing I'd like to say is, of course, now that Laura is our the designated housing representative. So we do need someone who represents housing. That's what has a program they're connected to that has housing. So that will mean that you might talk a little bit more that is part of my understanding of the suite of services provided by the foundation.
It is, and you heard about the services that we provide. It is not within my area of expertise though. So I would actually encourage the so HOPWA specifically is not a required C. It's one of the ones that used to be, but is no longer. Okay. I would encourage the council to find somebody who has more direct housing expertise than I do, because I work at a large organization that also provides housing, but that doesn't mean that I, aside from asking questions about HUD, obnoxious HUD letters, I don't actually have any expertise as a housing provider, so I feel like the council can do better than.
Yeah, you know, I can talk to there's someone actually from the foundation who first brought it forward. The main thing is that we have to have someone who fits in a role as who's associated with housing, but we can absolutely talk.
Mine for purposes of check boxes and grant applications, but I feel like the council would be better served to have someone with a more depth knowledge.
The third thing is there is still 2 minutes. This is a pretty rich presentation. We kind of rushed at the end. So if there's any questions you'd like to ask, kind of, well, we do have a couple more minutes.
Yes. But, you know, like if I look at the DMR, see, and the person wins the lottery, right? They do. Why don't they have those high HOA terms? Exactly. It's like the person, you know, they get in and you have the income guidelines and they get like a $1,600. It's like, oh, this is great. Then they put a $600 for the HOA.
Unfortunately, a lot of times within newer developments, they do have HOAs, and it's unfortunate because, as Helen pointed out, we have people who become disabled or cannot afford it. So they need a newer, comfortable building with an elevator, and most of those facilities are, they want rents for the highest amount of fair market rent. So again, that's what trying to start to get ready for program, because they really ask for the most. And then there are all these hidden fees. We try to counsel people not, you know, y'all see my presentation, but we look at Craigslist, we look at apartments.com. Not that, you know, BMR is no CD, but I would say there are other people. But yeah, unfortunately, whenever we do set up a developer, it's a big
complicated process. Yeah, I know that's really support, but it's relative, like if you can have a $700,000 house, your HOA bill. I'm going to be as high as one
they charge. And that's a good point. So when you're working with housing navigation, that is something to note. And I'm usually trying to inform our housing navigators that, like, explain there will be all these out of nowhere nickel and dime fees. There are people with lockout fees, all kinds of stuff. Some of those things can be waived. So, you know, if you have a supportive animal, you don't have to pay a deposit. You can get that taken care of. And the building said they don't allow it. We can still work around that. But we do try to work where we can, and I just try to tell people go for a little more affordable options, Craigslist, apartment, all of those types of things.
So in our last minute, is there any public comment on this agenda item?
I think okay. Thank you, Manuel, for your service.
Thank you.
We love people to see you around.
Yes.
Was there any public comment on this item?
I wanted to also thank Madeline for all of his work in the community. It's great to have a partner like you in the office.
Thank you. I humbly really appreciate all of your partnership and all your support. I have one more round of applause.
Thank you. All
right, meeting's adjourned.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, I'm going to say, I want to say,